Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Some of my closest allies in the profession, they just made so much fun of us and thought the idea was stupid. Gave us names even like the Blubber Restaurant, the Whale Penis, the Seal Fucker. That's how it is when you try for something new, when you risk something new, then you also risk being shot at.
And they were right. For the most part, we were just pretentious and it was crap. This is crap.
Hi, I'm Paco Romain.
And I'm George Chen.
And you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we discuss and dissect documentaries chosen by our guests from the worlds of comedy, film, television, and more.
And today marks this very special day for us. It's our 5-year anniversary of SupDoc.
And to celebrate, we're talking food documentaries all month long for Munchie May, our brand new theme series.
On this episode, we talk to comedian Derek Sheen about his pick, Noma, My Perfect Storm.
For 3 years running, Noma in Copenhagen was voted the best restaurant in the world by Restaurant Magazine. This put an immense amount of pressure on René Redzepi, the driven chef who has upended the food world and put Nordic cuisine on the map. He has an attitude and brilliance that is undeniable, but he starts questioning his own motivations and ideas about success.
And our guest is Derek Sheen, a cuddly mess of insecurities and a gifted, one-of-a-kind storyteller. His dark humor has made Derek a cult favorite of comedy nerds everywhere. He's amassed a loyal fan base touring with comedy legends Brian Posehn, Patton Oswalt, and Janine Garofalo. Derek has released 4 critically acclaimed albums on Stand Up Records with Grammy-winning producer Dan Schlissel. The most recent, Macho Caballero, just came out in April 2020 and is on streaming services everywhere.
And now, here's Derek Sheen.
Hey, this is George and Paco, and we're talking to comedian Derek Sheen. Hi, Derek.
Hello. Hello. How are you guys?
Hi, Derek.
Hi.
Hey, I feel like I've not seen you in several years.
So, it's been so long, George. It's been a couple of years at the earliest.
Yeah. And Paco, you guys have worked together before? Or you're aware of each other or no?
I've never met Derek, although
I've
sent you a message, a heartfelt message. But you
what did you say? Did you send a little nice note?
I did. Derek, you don't remember Derek, do you?
I'm running through my memory right now.
Damn. The 1 minute in, we've created like a total like Mark Maron, like, are we good kind of moment.
What did your old man do, Derek? What did your old man do?
You know what? I do remember. My old man was in the mob. So,
oh, shit.
Wait, what? Well, fuck my message. What? Let's start there.
I thought that's what you were legitimately asking me. I was like, that's what my old man did.
No, that's just what Mark Maron asked everybody.
That's my old man.
This has nothing to do with Munchie May, but we need to know about this now.
Yeah. Let me just say, though, I'm going to talk about my message real quick to Derek. I saw a post that you had about being in your 40s or whatever, and being like, should I stop? Should I quit? Does it matter anymore? Do I matter anymore? Should I even go on the road? Who fucking cares? And it really resonated with me. It really fucking resonated with me because I am in my 40s, and I was like, does it matter? Do I matter? Who fucking cares? And I read that, and you're like, fuck yeah, it matters, because I love this, but I'm not putting all of my eggs in one basket anymore. I'm not putting everything into this success that may or may not happen. I just want to enjoy comedy again. And I sent you a message saying, like, that really resonated with me, and I was so happy that you wrote that.
I do remember this because I read it. I read that message right before I was going up on stage. And right. I think I told you that it just totally juiced me and made me love comedy again. I do remember. I do. I got to go through the memory banks.
That's
but
right.
yeah, that, it was incredibly inspiring because we're both in that same age range.
Yes.
And to hear somebody else go like, you know what? Just like I'm happy to be a feature. I'm happy to be doing this. And just remember what, you know, the reason that you're doing it for. And I was like, holy crap, I needed to hear that so bad.
Yeah.
Yes, I do remember. And
it's a good time to bring up you're both comedians in case no one knows what we're talking about. Just like, God, what was going on with these two? What were they doing on stage?
We're both into sewing. It was a big sewing championship. Yeah. So but anyways, that really resonated with me because I'd literally been going through the same thing. And I read that and I was like, oh, that's right. This is supposed to be fun. And then, yeah, you wrote back and you're like, I've got like 5 minutes before I go on stage. And thank you for sending me this message. And I was like, that's awesome.
Yes. Thank you. That was awesome. I remember now. And yes, that helped me through a dark time, by the way.
Awesome. Oh, that's
good
awesome.
Stuff.
I'm happy to hear that. And so weird segue, but your dad was in the mob.
Yeah, I legitimately didn't even know that was a Marin call. I was like, oh, yeah, my dad, he was in the mob. Yeah, he worked for I'm writing about it right now, which is taking forever because it sucks. But yeah, he worked for the Calicuccio family, which was the Seattle version of the Genovese crime family in New York. So they had pockets all over the place. And of course, they were in a fight with the Bananos family at the time for the territory. My dad was not Italian. He was Irish. So of course now everybody asks him, what is your dad a house painter?
Right.
And, he just paints houses. But no, he literally killed a bunch of dudes. So,
and
yeah.
You found out this when?
When
how
I was,
old how old were you?
16 when I met him.
Oh, and you met
he was in the, yeah, he was in Lompoc for 9 years for conspiracy and treason. Before that, he was in San Francisco lockup for 4 years awaiting a murder trial where he was acquitted. But basically because the FBI wanted to hire him as an informant. So they had him turn state's evidence, but cleared him publicly and then put him back into the mob. And for a while, he basically just did whatever he wanted because he had carte blanche and then went right back into prison. And the FBI was like, nope.
Oh my God.
That's, yeah.
You know what? Always a mobster. Once a mobster, always a mobster. Isn't that what they say?
And,
you can't.
And then DEA informant from 1989 or 90 until about maybe 5 years before his death.
Wow. That's incredible. Sorry to hear that your dad passed away, but that's pretty incredible. And I'm also very happy that you're writing a book about that. Because my dad was a fireman, so we didn't have that much fun, you know. Isn't that fun?
God, I would have given anything to have no drama. Like, just have a public servant who was a hero. I would love that instead of being like, my dad took people's lives because he was lazy. He was so lazy. That's the laziest job.
It kind of is. I never thought about that. Mobsters are they're lazy by nature, and they're criminal.
Yeah, I mean,
you mix the two.
It's high stress. But it's still lazy, you know?
Yeah, that is a little lazy. That's true.
Like, the worst that can happen is you get murdered.
Right.
That's the worst that can happen. Like, you don't get fired. And they're like, hey, get out of here. Collect unemployment. And you're like, hey, can you lay me off, Tony? Because I don't.
Yeah.
You can't, I need to collect unemployment. Yeah, you can't do that.
Are they getting Small Business Administration? Yeah.
PUA. It's the pandemic, whatever assistance.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. And I hope that you make it into a documentary so that we can have you back on and talk about it.
Yeah.
That would be
awesome. I was going to say, like, usually what we do in May is we used to do just true crime every May as a theme month, and we were like, let's try something different, and like you immediately brought it back to true crime. But we are trying something different for this May. We're doing Munchie May, so we're talking about food documentaries. It's an area that for doing this show for 5 years, Derek, this is our 5-year anniversary of doing SupDoc, and we have only done like two food documentaries up to now.
Oh, wow.
So, And I hit you up because I've eaten your food. You've made food for me. You have a bit about food that I love, like the biscuit thing. And also, I think you threw a couple of docs at me, and I had not seen this Noma doc. And I loved it. I love this Noma documentary. Tell us a little bit about why you picked the Noma My Perfect Storm.
Well, first off, because, I mean, Rene Redzepi's, you know, sort of the... Him and Ferran Adrià of El Bulli in Spain, I think, are two of the greatest chefs walking the earth and the most imaginative and creative guys. And the fact that, like, I mean, we're in a very creative field, all three of us. And getting to that place where you have not only you mastered something, but you don't allow that to stop you from exploring and creating when you've hit that peak. There's very few people that are like that, you know. We know comics and musicians and artists that they hit a place and then that's it. And they stay there and they're comfortable. And when you're not hungry, you don't struggle. And when you don't struggle, you don't create. And but you see people who aren't in it for that. They're in it because that the juice of trying to better themselves every day is what drives them to be even more spectacular. You know, it's this is going to sound so stupid, but I remember, when I was probably in my late teens, I read an interview with Eddie Van Halen, right? And Eddie Van Halen, the world's greatest guitar player, right? One of. And
we've lost everyone under 20.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
At this point.
I'm so sorry.
That's fine. And we're talking about restaurants and like, yeah. It's fine.
But I read this interview with him where someone asked him, like, are you confident in your playing? And, you know, is there a certain point where you just go, I got it. Like, I'm the best. And he said, the minute you start thinking that and you rest on your laurels, the less opportunities you have to get better or reach new places you didn't know about. So he always tells himself that I'm not, anytime I think I'm good enough, I always remember someone's better than me and it makes me stay on track. And that's the difference between a creative and someone who just merely creates, you know? So that's what drew me to the documentary, is watching someone like Rene Redzepi, who's sort of, to me, like the Van Halen of food.
Yeah, but how did you know about him before? Like, you knew about the restaurant, you knew about Noma just from being a food person, and then you saw this?
Yeah, I read about the documentary on Eater.com, which is a great resource for, you know, all food all over the world. But it was a really great review. And of course, it's Rene Redzepi, and I'm never going to get to go to Noma ever. That's just an impossibility. I don't have that kind of money or time, or why would I want to go to a Nordic country for one meal that's going to cost me enough to be buried? Like, that's, you know, that's all of my money, all my death money.
It's funeral cost money.
Your death money. Yeah,
it's my death money. But I wanted to, you know, I really wanted to see what goes into it, because I think that's also more inspiring than eating that food, is the creative process. And I've seen the El Bulli documentary, and I read the it was a great book by someone who was a stagiaire for El Bulli, which means they worked as a stager, which is a volunteer job. Okay. You come and you work there for training, to learn how to work in every different position of the restaurant in the chain, you know, as far as like from milk skin to, you know, learning how to cook duck breast or rendering fat. Everyone has a particular job. And when you leave that restaurant, even though you're not getting paid, you just worked in the most famous restaurant of all. So now your resume is wide open. So people will take that 6 months or 9 months and work for free and live, you know, in a hovel, and show up every day from 6 a.m. until 3 a.m. for 9 months straight and have their chops busted for that, you know, that opportunity. And it was an amazing book, but it's a whole different level, you know. It's just a different level of not just the work, but the constant being open to all of those influences and all of that creative influence. It just makes you want to just make things.
Success is a marvelous thing, don't get me wrong, but it can be dangerous and limiting. The truth is, I'd started feeling scared of losing this worldwide precious attention that we'd stumble into. we'd suddenly become a fancy restaurant. I became a miserable fuck. Shouting all the time, pushing people around, the smallest things became disasters. We started listening to other people's questions like, you should have real silverware now. Are you sure you have enough luxury ingredients on the menu because all the various guides and institutions dictate it? Langoustines, lobsters, or caviar? Or should the waiters now wear suits? Like the food would then improve with a fucking bow tie. Fuck the real silver cutlery. In Macedonia, I ate the chicken of my life with my bare hands. Are you telling me silver cutlery would have made it better? No. The quality, what made it special, was having a connection to what we put in our mouths. That it was a very rare treat, a moment of celebration. We were receiving guests, and we wanted to give them the best we could afford to offer. We wanted to make them happy. From then on, I decided we would spend all we could afford on ourselves. Fuck the bow ties. Thank you.
When we decided to do our Munchie May food theme month, we were thinking about how the restaurants and food businesses we love are being hit really hard by shelter in place, and how they've all had to change the nature of their services during this pandemic.
That's why we decided to give some shout-outs to our friends and fans that work in the food industry. Local food sourcing has always been important, but we're really seeing how much we all depend on small operators in times like these. And as podcasters, we love other scrappy independent businesses and want to support them. So for this episode, we wanted to shout out my friend Uli's pretzel business in Berkeley, California, called Squabish. Uli was born in Sindelfingen, Germany. Guten Tag to anyone in Sindelfingen that's listening right now.
Yeah, ich habe Hunger und ich liebe Squabish.
Gesundheit. The region in Germany is known for pretzels. After decades working in the music industry, which is how I know him, Uli started selling pretzels and teaching German cooking as a side hobby.
Ausgezeichnet. Squabish sells at farmers markets and pop-up events in the East Bay. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Squabish has started to offer their pretzels via curbside pickup and some local delivery from their bakery in Berkeley, California.
Yeah, I really wish I could be up there and making my order. Paco, you got to taste these for me because I looked on the website and there was an amazing variety of artisanal pretzels. He's got like 30 types listed.
I'm gonna try a lot of these, okay?
Yeah. I mean, look at this. Anchovies and capers.
Yum.
Prosciutto and ham. Pesto and mozzarella. Even the sweet kinds. There's salted caramel. I saw peanut butter, dark peanut butter buttercup, chocolate buttercup thing.
Oh my gosh.
Oh
yes.
Man. I'm like, you gotta mail me some down here. But you know, to place your orders at Squabish, you have to go find their website, which is squabish.com. That's spelled Squabish. Squabish. And they're also on Facebook and Instagram. And it's Squabish Food with a California twist. And to tell them SupDoc sent you. Right, Paco?
That's right, buddy.
So, Derek, were you a cook? Were you a sous chef? Did you work in a restaurant? Why do you have this affinity with eating and cooking?
I think I wanted to be a chef, but and I didn't. I did work in restaurants coming up, but I never got past the line. I mean, I worked. I have a story. I've told a true story. I rarely tell, but I worked in a restaurant where they put me in a prep cook position, and it was a line, you know, sort of a garden mange kind of thing, and fine dining. I'm saying in air quotes. But it was really like, it was a hotel restaurant. It was kind of fancy, but it wasn't fine dining.
Right.
But the cooks there, I was the only, I was the only white dude. And I, unfortunately, because I'm a white American, I only speak one language because I'm lazy and I don't apply myself to anything other than what my own interests are. And so I worked in a kitchen full of people who didn't speak English. And I was there 20 minutes. I had my apron on. I was cutting vegetables. And all the dudes there, of course, any kitchen, they're going to razz you and make fun of you when you're new. And it's even worse when you're the youngest dude and you don't speak their language. They're having the best time of their life. And I'm like, I'm not, you know what? I've earned it. I have to get my balls busted. Fine. But then all I heard was a crash, like a screech of metal and a crash. Yeah. And I turned around. And one of the dudes was holding his pants and just started yelling, owie, I hurt my pee-pee. And he had taken his dick out and put it on a cutting board while everyone was goofing around. And a whole rack of cast iron pots and pans came down on top of it. I took my apron off and walked by the manager's office and went, thanks, but no thanks. And I was like, I can't, this is too much for me. Too many responsibilities. I couldn't do it.
What? That's how you get the norovirus.
That's how you got to maintain a cast iron skillet.
Yeah. That's how you clean a cast iron skillet. People don't know that.
They don't know that.
They don't know that.
I wanted to work in kitchens my whole life, but I didn't get a lot of support from my family as well. Like, they were all mechanics. Wanted me to work in the shop, not an interest of mine. And I played music. I did makeup. I painted. I did all these other weird extracurricular creative things, which were far removed from the rest of the family. So It sort of black sheeped me for a while.
Yeah.
My grandfather offered to send me to chef school after high school. But I quit high school to go because I was living on my own. And I went, I can't do both of these things. So I quit high school. And instead of sending me to chef school, which would have given me a trade, he was like, well, why would I pay for chef school if you're not going to finish high school? And now I'm a comedian.
Right. Thanks, Grandpa.
You guys have so much in common.
How old were you? How old were you when you were on your own?
I moved out when I was six. All right, I moved out from my mom's place when I was about 14.
Wow.
And then I lived all over the place. I lived with friends. I tried to finish high school. I ended up in an apartment. God damn it. Okay, so I ended up in an apartment. At 16, I was selling carpet at Nielsen Brothers. I lied about my age. I had a little suit and everything, right?
Nice, yeah.
And I had an apartment that I didn't have to pay rent for because my roommate was a 36-year-old convicted child molester. And his mom said, if you just promise to keep an eye on my son and be his roommate, I'll let you stay there for free. I lived
rent-free. When you're underage?
I was 16. He wasn't interested in me. I was too old. So I had just skated under the wire, free rent, and all I had to do was keep an eye on Neil. That was it.
Oh, my God. Fucking Neil. How many denim jackets did Neil own?
He actually had a denim vest.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, man.
And he always had one harmonica in a pocket somewhere.
Of course he did.
Oh, yeah.
It's the easiest way to get kids to follow you. Pied Piper. Oh, God. Pedophilia. Ugh. Yeah. That's, wow. Fuck. So, you, in a... there is like a correlation then between you, like you, and now I see why you like Renee so much. Like, he's kind of a maverick. He was kind of an outsider. Like, he talks about that in this documentary, moving from Macedonia to Denmark. Like, he kind of does things his own way. Like, he doesn't follow a certain path. That sounds like kind of the life that you created for yourself as well.
Yeah, he was kind of, I mean, he was an outsider when he moved back to Denmark, and he was an outsider in Macedonia, and, you know, his family wanted him to go into a trade. But I think that, and they all cooked. I mean, his mom cooks for a living. You know, his dad was a businessman. But I think you just get to a place where you, if you emancipate yourself to a certain extent and you're already an artist or a creative, you just gravitate towards the opposite energy of your parents all the time. You know, most of the time, unless you live in Hollywood.
Right.
And then you get into your parents' business because it's fun. But like, I think that, yeah, I do see some correlation. I definitely, I could definitely recognize a lot of Renee's struggle, and you know, and that level of creativity, I think I feel like that with my stand up.
Right.
That it's not just, I'm not just going out and doing jokes. I'm trying to do something unique and different, and it's going to take a long time to make it take off. And you've got to work at a different pace, and you're going to have a lot of failure, and the failure is grand and is significant and painful, but it's worth it. You know, it's worth it in the end, because the few people that love it, you know? And
yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of correlations between, I think, like a chef and a comic, or at least in this documentary, it seemed that way, especially like when he's yelling at those three guys and the girl, the two guys.
God.
Like, every time that shot kept coming back, I got so much anxiety because I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been yelled at by a boss and him demanding, like, why isn't this better? And I'm just like, I don't fucking know. Like, you're the genius. I don't know.
You're the genius.
I don't know.
I just wanted someone to say that. I just wanted one of those chefs to go, like, you're the fucking boss. What do you want from me? Like, Christ. Just tell me.
Yeah, do you want me to put more ants in this or something? What do you want from me? I know, dude. And it's like he's yelling at it like a hostile crowd, basically, like comedians have to sometimes.
You know? Oh, yeah.
Like, we've tried this. We've tried this, and it didn't work. So what do you want from, you know, like, he's like, I can't just be here anymore. You know, like,
why are you just staring at me? Say something. Why are you just staring at me?
Yeah.
I mean, that's comedy in a nutshell.
Amen.
Like, tell me what you want. Why are you staring at me?
Exactly.
We don't have the authority over the people, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just being like, yeah, him turning into kind of like a yelly boss was like, huh, I sort of saw that in him, because he's kind of got like this very punk attitude, a very like, I'm going to flip the script on everything, or just a lot of flipping off the camera. It's like, I'm like, okay, if you were in America, you'd be like hanging out with, if you grew up as American, it'd be like Jeff Lowe with his Affliction shirts or whatever. he has a lot of attitude, and I kind of identified with that. This to me, I think someone mentions Mozart in this, and I was like, this is very like Amadeus. It's very like just about like kind of troubled. He's not that troubled, but kind of like the genius who's just driven and like hard on himself. But like Amadeus wasn't that hard on himself. Amadeus just kind of like was like, I'm just floating along. But just like being like kind of like he was 32 when he got the best restaurant in the world. That's like crazy to me. That's 32 years old in 2010. Yeah.
Oh,
so he's born in, yeah. So he was born, what, like 78? No.
78.
Can't do math. But yeah, he's like, yeah, he in 2010, he was like, yeah, he was a 32-year-old when they got, when Noma got that award.
Wow.
And that's, yeah, it's bonkers. And just like, that's another thing. We didn't have that level of success when we were all 32. So that's a big difference between us and Rene Redzepi.
Yeah, no, I was toiling away in the music industry, just being like, what the fuck am I doing here? No.
Bingo.
Yeah.
That's where I was. Oh.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I music retail up until I was 35 when I finally quit my job.
Tower Records?
No, like instruments.
Oh.
Guitar and bass and teaching music and because I kept thinking I wanted to do stand-up that whole time, but I was like, I'm not funny.
Right.
So I'll just do this until I get funny. Hopefully I'll have something that'll keep me busy or on stage until I can get funny. And then eventually I think I got in my 30s and was like, oh, I found myself a little bit. Now I have some footing.
How old were you when you started stand-up?
I mean, I started when I was a kid. But I didn't really pursue it again until my late 20s is when I started chasing again. Because I got into music and I had really bad stage fright. And I found like if I'm in a band, that's so much easier. I can be on stage, but no one's looking right at me because I could just put my head down and do what I needed to do. But then I think in my late 20s, I started kind of coming out of my shell. And then I was like, oh, I get it. Like I'm a late bloomer.
Right.
Everybody else is very self-aware in their 20s, and they're like, this is when I become myself, and I don't think I really hit my stride until 41. So,
yes, amen to that, man. So that's really, the Mozart thing's pretty interesting. I just, what's the phrase, enfant terrible or whatever, like?
Yeah, enfant terrible.
Yeah.
Throw a little French on it. Yeah.
Yeah. It just, that's what I got that feeling from him. Like, he seemed like the kind of guy that, like, you would go and have a couple beers with, but by the end of the night, there's going to be some argument in the parking lot, you know, and everyone kind of goes home, like kind of wishing they didn't go out and have those beers.
Is he progressive rock Guy Fieri? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
He reminds me of like a jungle DJ or something from the 90s.
Like his, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Like an angry jungle DJ.
Yeah.
He just seemed contradictory to me. He was like, I don't care if people don't like me. I don't give a fuck. And then he's like, people don't like me? What am I supposed to do? I want them to enjoy my rut, you know? Then he's like, I don't care if I get the best restaurant in the world. Then he's like, this is the best thing that's ever happened.
You know? Yeah.
I understand. He's human. And I mean, I get that part, but it was just, and then he's like, you know, my employees are my brothers and my sisters. And he's like, look at me. Like, what is, you know, like, don't walk away. Yeah. I don't know. It's kind of very interesting, but he's an intense character, man. And chefs are intense. Do you guys personally know a chef?
Yes.
They're intense fucking people.
Yeah. And he's not like a fine dining chef either. I mean, he's a jobber, been working restaurant to restaurant. So he's just got a patina. I think his first layer of skin is just scar tissue.
Right. And, chefs always have like nasty arms. They always have like gross arms.
Oh, so gross. Yeah. And luckily covered in tattoos, so you don't see all the burns. But like, he's the last guy that would get pissed if you brought him regular time instead of lemon time.
Yeah.
I'd be like, cool, fucking time. What are we supposed to do with this anyways? It's a diner. What are we doing?
Oh. You know? Yeah, when they were smoking the egg thing, I just didn't know what to do with myself. I'm such a burger and fries and like a diner kind of dude that like fine dining literally makes me anxious. I don't get it, and I don't necessarily enjoy it.
Oh.
I want to. I want to be that person. I want to be refined and stuff, but...
Do you feel like it's like art or something? Like if like you're going to a museum and like, oh, do I eat the piece? Or like, do you feel like it's just like there's too many barriers to entry in terms of like the concepts?
I think it's mostly the high concept, not enough food situation.
Well, it is expensive.
Yeah.
For a small amount of food.
I mean, growing up in like the Midwest, I think I'm just used to like burgers and fries and some goulash or something, you know. And I've been to a friend of mine owns a Michelin rated restaurant here in San Francisco, and I've been a few times and it's awesome, but I'm like, you know, I usually leave just being like, God, you want to go to In-N-Out Burger now? Like,
that's exactly it. Okay, so Posehn and I a couple times when we were in San Francisco last year, the year before, no, it was last year, he was like, hey, I kind of just want to go to a couple of these places and like dig in. And, you know, we're food nerds when we're on the road, but I was like, this is going to be a huge thing. You know, it's a big endeavor. You got to make reservations 3 or 4 months in advance if you're lucky. And I was like, all right, I'm fucking stoked to do this. And I think both of us were not expecting, you know, you think about the tasting menu and you're like, all right, well, better make plans for after, you know?
Right.
But 20 courses, even in a tasting menu, I was like, and then we had to do a show that night. I have never been so wrong in my life. I was like, oh, this is just a spoonful of cream. And then they're like, here's some tender slices of beef loin that have been smoked for 12 days. And you're like, all right, well, I'm not going to be, oh, man. And then by the time they bring out dessert, you're like, fuck off.
Right.
Seriously, stop. Stop doing this. Stop and bringing plates.
This was paired with wine, or was it like a pairing kind of thing?
No, I think he did the wine. I don't drink anymore, so I was like Diet Coke because I suck.
Right.
And
you're fine.
I'm having my $800 meal with Diet Coke. And
what was the restaurant?
I want to remember. It's something bird. It's or caged bird or
no. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's not field bird. Fuck. That's supposed to be in an awesome restaurant. I've never been, but I've heard
it was one of the best, actually one of the best meals I've ever had. There's one thing that Brian and I still talk about that we had out of that tasting menu that was the most amazing thing I've ever put in my mouth. Like I just wanted to ask him, like the chef, like, can you just make 8 more of these?
Right.
Whatever this is, like everything else is off the charts amazing. But this one thing, It was some uni, something that was paired with uni and this foam. But then there was this sort of bacon foam that they made, and it was bacon bananas. Foam. Yeah, it was crazy.
Was it state bird?
Provisions.
State
bird.
I've heard of that.
Provisions. Yeah.
Okay.
That's supposed to be a very fancy, really amazing. Friends of mine went there for my buddy's 50th birthday. They went there and had the same thing, 20-course meal, and just like, yeah, it was like $1,000 a person with wine and
so crazy.
Yeah, that's nuts. This place is supposed to be amazing. I've been to a couple like really nice restaurants, and actually, to be honest, both of them I've been to. My friend owns Francis in San Francisco, which is top rated restaurant in the world, and you actually leave pretty full. More beef knuckle, and you're like, sure, I'll have more beef knuckle.
I think part of the allure isn't so much the idea of sustenance as it is, you know, the idea of exploration.
Right.
And so for some of these places, you go in not unlike going into a gallery, you know, like you may not see things you recognize, and it may not be all of the art in the world, but there's this weird trip that they take you down, this weird journey they take you on. And the chef's idea of like, this is what food can do, or this is what I imagine it can do. And then you just have these moments. I think that's the beauty of it is, you know, you may leave hungry, but there's this amazing thing if they do it right, where you're enjoying a moment. It's just one moment. It's something in your brain, in your mouth, your surroundings, the environment, the ambiance, everything just, if it works right in combination, in concert, you just have this experience.
Right.
And then you leave and you go, wow, that was cool. I mean, I love food. But that's an interesting way to look at food, you know, or going to see a gamelan ensemble. You're like, I don't necessarily listen to gamelan music, but if I'm going to be there, this is amazing. Like, that served a purpose, you know, like all these people put in all this work for this one thing, and it takes you on a journey. And I think that's food's got a lot of different roles. But, you know, of course, survival is one of them. But there's a place where if you can afford it, food can also just be interesting.
Yeah.
And it can be fun. We can explore flavors or ideas, but yeah, only because that it piques our interest creatively. And that's the purpose that it serves. So am I talking too much? I'm so sorry. I do this all the time.
No.
Yacker.
That's why we have you as a guest. No, that's awesome. What you just said was perfectly summed up. I thought that was perfectly summed up. And let's talk a little bit about risk. Like, so the three of us take a lot of risks in our lives as professional comedians. That's what you do basically. And it's being risk averse can be problematic in being a comedian, a musician, or a chef. So I kind of felt like, let me ask you guys this. Like, I felt like the theme of this documentary was risk. Now I'm interested what you guys have to think about that. And if you think there's a different theme that was happening, cause you know, there's a lot of, you're in a safe space basically is what I'm saying. So let's explore the idea of risk for a second. Like I thought the theme of this was to not necessarily have, you know, goals that you want to meet each and every week. It's to take risk and to divide and conquer and drill down into like different kinds of ingredients and things like that. George, what do you think?
I was thinking about it. I wasn't thinking so much about risk, but it's tied to that, which is sort of like limitation as an innovation, right? So that was what they did. The first innovation they did was like, let's limit everything to Scandinavian ingredients and just create like a Scandinavian cuisine. And then like, I find like what we're talking about, like music and other things like that, limitations are like having infinite possibilities, like it can be more paralyzing. And when you have a limitation or a set of rules or restrictions, then you can get creative in a different way than you expected. So I think that's something he talked about, which I think is true in other art forms.
I agree. And I think, I mean, as he discussed early in the movie, you know, I think a big theme of that, that resonates is being genuine and being true to yourself, finding out what your core message is and being true to that. Which is also, I mean, that's also taking a huge risk. But I think when he talks about the fact that, he got made fun of when they came up with their restaurant concept, and rightly so, because it was stupid, you know, and it was really pretentious. And it was one of those like highbrow things just for the sake of being highbrow.
Right.
And not because it had any meaning behind it or it didn't have a message. And then when he took that trip, you know, when he took a trip out of Norway to Greenland and just sort of like all that shit came off of him. And he was like, oh, man, like this should just be about my exploration, like the things that I'm fascinated. If I'm fascinated by it, other people will be as long as I believe in it. And I think that when he went back with that more energized concept, which it wasn't just Scandinavia or Norway, it was like local ingredients that are foraged that, you know, that showcase things about Norway that no one would have ever known. And how can you be creative in this environment that's dark for so long and cold and wet and still bring this, you know, and still find things that aren't just moldy, you know, or just like, you know, aren't just boiled. How do you find this essence, this harmony in all these things? I mean, God, that by the way, just side note, the scene where they are in the fermentation room, where they're just fermenting everything.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Like that to me is at that point, you're just exploring. You're just seeing what things do. You're pushing envelopes and you know, half that stuff no one's ever going to eat. No one's ever going to try it. But his brain is like, what happens if I do this? What happens if I ferment bacon for so long? So I think a lot of it is just being genuine with his actual message, finding what his core value was, and then, you know, following that. And whether he gets a third star or not, he doesn't give a shit anymore, because now he realizes he's following his vision to its most finite and genuine conclusion. That's the truest creative voice I think you can hear.
Right. Absolutely. 100%. George, do you have something to interject?
I was thinking about also like in terms of like innovation or like evolution of ideas, there's also the Saturday night projects, right? That's when the staff actually gets to like do their experiments. And that is also like this weird thing of the mentor and the mentee relationship happening, which we don't see a ton of, but I know like people leave Noma and start their own restaurants. Like I went down a YouTube hole and there's this guy in Russia who used to be like a head chef at Noma, who like just basically took everything he learned from Noma and applied it to like Russian ingredients. So, but that's a really fun scene to me about like that anyone who's been in a creative thing where you just need that approval from like a mentor figure, you know, I think we've all sort of had that moment, and it's just sort of this nice, it's nice compared to later when he yells at them. That's what I'm
saying. I had that feeling that like, as I'm watching them bring up their dishes, like there's a certain class of people that have worked in that industry that, and when you're at that level, even if you're working at Noma as an intern in the kitchen, you're at such an elevated level that nothing you serve is going to be that fucked up. And it just made me think, like, if I was there, like if it was one of those situations where it's like, all right, Saturday night special, what are you guys cooking? It was just us. The shit he would have to look at.
Like,
all right.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a vegetarian lasagna, but I put some radishes on top, and I made a potato rose. I just made a rose out of potatoes. Exactly.
I put ranch dressing in a balloon, and you take a candle and you pop it, and then it goes all over your potatoes. And
like if that documentary was on Fox instead of like independently created, that's what it would have been. It's just idiots bringing him their dog shit food. Like, what do you think of this? And he's like, oh, well, it's on a plate. We could use that.
Yeah, that's hilarious. If it was on Fox, oh my God. Yeah, that is. I mean, I don't like most of these guys don't go to school, right? I mean, most of these guys start in a kitchen somewhere as a line cook or something, and then just kind of you work your way up generally, right? To like chef.
Yes,
yeah,
yes. I think you start in a position, and I think if you catch the fever, You know, not unlike anything else, like stand up. You know, if you go to enough open mics, if that fever hits you, you just start it and
right.
you don't worry about anything in between. You just dive in and take whatever jobs you can get.
Now, this is sort of a good time to bring in another commonality between stand up comedy and restaurants. We're all fucked, right? In the state that we're in at the moment in quarantine world. But individual stand ups have figured out how to do what they do through Zoom. And other, you know, Instagram Live and things like that. Restaurants have, some of them in LA have pivoted to turning into grocery store kind of pantry things. But like fine dining, and I think there's a big article with David Chang where he said basically like this industry is going to be decimated when we come out of this. Like I'm like wondering what is going to happen with. And this is sort of like not addressed in the documentary. Obviously, the documentary is not about this stuff, but I'm just thinking about it, why we even wanted to cover food in this moment. It's like, well, documentaries about restaurants might be the last thing we have about restaurants in a few years, you know? So I don't know. It's just an interesting, not to bring it down as I always do. I always bring things down. That is my brand of comedy. I don't know. How are you guys thinking about your relationship to food, your relationship to restaurants? And also your relationship to your own creativity as we are in this bizarre world. Big question that sort of tangentially relates to the documentary. Just like, you know, we're all kind of going through it right now. I think our listeners are as well.
I mean, food, restaurants in general, the concept of a restaurant is a social environment. And so, I mean, that's the first thing is that we are completely robbed of that experience in lockdown. And we go out not because of the sustenance again. We go out to eat for the experience. You know, we want to hang out. We don't want to be at home. We want to be in a different environment. We want someone else to take care of us. It's all social. We hear other people's conversations. You know, that influences our conversations. And now we're home. We're home for 2 months. And I think, I mean, out here, it's really the restaurant industry is fucked overall. But I mean, like here, we lost all the Tom Douglas restaurants. Like 2 weeks ago, he said, I'm broke. I'm done. That's an empire out here. I mean, the Tom Douglas restaurants, especially downtown, like for some reason, I'm forgetting the name of the big one, the Palace Kitchen. But that the Palace Kitchen's been here for 25 years. It's been a staple.
And you're in Seattle.
And it's amazing. I mean, it's just this great big wood-fired kitchen, and it's, you know, high. It's, it's fine dining, but it's not elevated. You can go in casual, but the food's amazing. The experience is great. That's done. The other 12 restaurants that he opened are all done. He's just done. You know, I think we're Canless, which is, you know, that's 3 Michelin stars. It's James Beard Award winner. It's probably one of the oldest fine dining restaurants in the United States. And they're in the parking lot selling hamburgers right now. They have a drive-through hamburger shack. And then they take orders for bigger group dinners for pickup, and that's it. And I think they'll come back, but in a much more reduced capacity. I mean, I think that we've seen fine dining is going to take a hit.
Derek, do you know a restaurant called Addo? Have you been to Addo, A-D-D-O?
I've heard of it. I have not been there. Mm.
Because there's that guy, Eric Rivera, wrote an article in Eater very recently that
I shared
with Paco. Yeah, about basically how, corporate chefs or chefs with big names like Wolfgang Puck are like being brought in by the Trump administration to like be the people that are going to bring back the restaurant industry. And then this Eric Rivera being like, this is not related to like any independent, like smaller restaurants.
No.
Sort of like, yeah. And the money, where's the money going? It's going to like, you know, Ruth Chris Steakhouse and stuff like that. So
yeah, Hubert Keller isn't going to help, you know, like, the fucking French Laundry isn't, you know, that's their own. It's wine country. Half those guys are in goddamn Sonoma County.
Right.
You know, they live off wine people. Like Thomas Keller, I think, is the last person that should be, even though he's an amazing chef, really shouldn't be telling or helping small businesses. That's never been his focus, you know?
Yeah.
He's a creative and not a, you know, he's a business guy, but he's not a business guy, you know?
Yeah, that's ingenuity is what happens sometimes when you're faced with like a crisis where you're either like, we either got to fucking think our way out of this or we stop, you know, and some people have to stop. And some people, like you're talking about that restaurant that's doing burgers in the parking lot, they're just like, all right, let's, we got to do this.
Yeah.
And then who knows what happens from there? Maybe they become the best burger makers in the world. You never know. You know? Like, that's what happens sometimes when you're literally at an end, is like, you either got to sink or swim and like think your way out of that fucking process, you know?
They did. Yeah. I mean, they, like, right out of the gate, they had, they started up a bagel stand in the parking lot.
Oh, nice.
That you could drive through in the morning and get your breakfast. And then at night, they, or afternoon, they had a burger stand, and then a burgers up until 6 p.m. and then a fine dining, like, dinner for four for $100.
Oh, wow.
And you can come pick it up. And, but I think that's what we're looking at. And if they do open here as soon, it's going to be incredibly reduced capacity, and that's going to change the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was watching this documentary, I was like, look at everyone just talking to each other and being 6 feet apart. And like, I hate this. It seems foreign, and it's only been like 2 months. It's so weird. It is so weird because it's, I mean, the future seems a little bleak at the moment. And it seemed kind of strange to see people just like casually hanging out. And then every time he would touch his face and his hair and they would like smell something or I was just like, oh, you can't do that. You
know? Those days are over. Those days are over.
Those days are over.
You and think, like, norovirus is a fear.
Right. Like,
oh, yeah, we got to talk about that. Like, that's sort of like why I like this. This is almost like the structure. Okay, going back to the actual movie in the Noma, My Perfect Storm. It's like the structure of a sports movie. There is sort of like that three quarters way through, like the dark hour has emerged. It's like, I'm the number two restaurant in the world. Boo hoo.
It's the whiff of death, Mark. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, yeah, then like that everyone gets sick off the muscles or whatever. And then they have to come back. They have to like really rebuild and everything. So I like that part of, you know, it gave it, I kind of liked watching him suffer a little bit. I don't know, not like, not from reality, but just like this guy's got so much angst. And like, I think I understand it. I think like the sort of racial aspect of it was dug into a little bit. It's like, he's Macedonian in Denmark. Denmark's a very monocultural, monoethnic kind of place. And I've spent like one day in Denmark. I've never been to Copenhagen. I would love to go to Copenhagen, but I've heard it's very difficult even for like people, if they marry a Dane, you don't get Danish citizenship right away. Like people will like work in Denmark and like drive back to like the Netherlands. You know, it's like that kind of, because their social services are so good. They don't like accept outsiders as rapidly. But like the stuff he was talking about, like being yelled at and being called like a Balkan dog and stuff, I'm like, whoa, what the fuck? Because for us, he's just another white guy.
Yeah,
it's just like, why are these white people mad at each other?
Yeah.
Oh, because like, white people are so good at, if we run out of people to hate, we'll just start hating each other. That's what right. We do.
We break other white people down into their specific bullshit. Yeah. And I was also like, and you're handsome and your wife's pretty and you have kids and you have employees in a restaurant. And I'm like, fuck, suck it up. Yeah.
Yeah. He's kind of a punk. Yeah. In like the good and the bad ways. He's like a punk.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I did not see that coming at all in the doc, was the racism thing. I was like, whoa, how did we get here? And then, you know, they show his dad and stuff, and I'm like, oh, like, okay, I did not know, because I didn't know anything about his back. I literally, in my hand of God, to be honest, I had to look up where Macedonia was on my phone. So, you know, I wasn't quite sure where the fuck Macedonia is.
I still have no idea like what the cuisine of Macedonia is from watching this, but I do think it's like it's kind of just the way he approaches everything, right? Like people are like, you're not Danish. He's like, fuck you. I'm going to be the most Danish by making the most local cuisine that exists.
Right.
You know, like he's just like, a lot of national identity is, I think, part of this, a theme of this movie as well.
Yeah. That's interesting. I really like the forager people. Like those guys were really interesting to me.
Such characters.
Yeah. The Santa Claus looking dude and the
oh man,
the farmers.
The forager dude was so cool. What a awesome hermit that guy is. And then, there's another dude. I'm trying to remember what his job was, though. He had there was later in the movie. I wasn't picking thistles. What the hell was he farming? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, there's a guy who just picked up ants And then they showed like a guy tapping syrup out of a tree. There was so many
weird syrup guy interviews.
Yeah.
Well, and the guy who got the uni, who was the Scotsman,
Yeah. The Scottish guy, yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, fuck you, you don't tell me what to do.
He's like, I'm a tough and sturdy Scotsman. You don't tell me what to do. And he's like, oh, but I kind of fell for his beard and his soft brown eyes. He did, he's like, had a little man crush on him. He's like, oh, he told me what to do, and I got him urchins, and I feel good about myself.
I put on my scuba gear, and I went for a swim. What am I, who am I?
Yeah, I can't stand fucking sea urchin. Have you guys ever had it?
I've had it, yeah.
Uni?
Yeah.
Ugh, blah. So gross. You guys like it?
That was your nightmare watching that scene of like the only uni and garlic dish or whatever. Yeah.
I was trying to figure out if those were almond slivers, but yeah, it was garlic. But Derek, do you like uni? You live in Seattle.
I do.
A lot of fresh fish.
Yeah, I like, I mean, it's rare that I get it, but it's very, yeah, I look forward to it. I love stinky shellfish. I love stinky stuff. I love rich, sort of odoriferous things. And that's kind of that's where my wife and I don't meet up.
Right. Yeah.
Derek, have you ever fucked with durian?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
What is it? What is durian?
Durian is a spiny fruit that sort of it resembles breadfruit. But upon opening durian or getting within 5 feet of it, you are immediately intoxicated by the smell of rotting flesh.
Oh.
The fruit itself sort of, whatever happens to the sugars and the enzymes in that fruit, it breaks down and smells like not just rot, but body rot, like corpse rot. And when you open it, it is incredibly strong. But if you get past the odor, the flavor of the fruit is great, and it takes a little while to get used to. It does. I think if you're from the States and you're not exposed to it, it takes a little time.
So again, another parallel to comedians, like kind of stinky, smells like rotting flesh. Till you get to know them, then they're cool and kind of nice.
Oh man, Dave! Someone had a bag of durian chips. this is a real thing. Oh man! It smelled up the car for a week. Just even getting rid of the chips, the smell was still there. What was your experience with it? I grew up,
you know, my family's from Taiwan. So like we would get it like maybe once every 2 or 3 years. And I still don't really know what a rotting corpse smells like. So I think when I smell a rotting corpse, I'll just think like that's durian rather than the other way around. I mean, I've smelled like dead thing. Oh my God. It reminds me of the worst smell. There was this metal band that played this club in San Francisco, and they just actually someone worked in a butcher shop and they just brought carcasses like in their van, and they just played inside El Rio, which is like a small like gay bar like in the Mission, and it was just like I literally cannot be in that room for more than like a minute. I just have to leave because they just like put like goat carcasses or whatever like on on stage with them. They're called Vassifor. Oh my God, that was like the stinkiest I think I've experienced at a music event ever. It's just like they like that was part of the show. Is the
and you've been to dead shows, so that says a lot.
Have you been to a dead show?
No, I've Paco? Never. No,
I never got the miracle. I was like always like I don't think I've. That's the only record I've ever broken over my knee is a Grateful Dead record.
God bless you, sir. Derek, you a deadhead?
No, not at all. No, I never got into it. I had friends who were super into it, and I went, it's not my thing. I'm a nerd.
Right.
I like progressive rock, so I'm the worst person to ask about music. My taste sucks. So
right from Rush to Yes, basically.
Oh no, those guys are like those are just the flagship progressive bands. I'm a deep dive into the real dog shit, like the stuff with no time signature, and they're just it's just noodly garbage. It just really speaks to me. It is just hot. Yeah, it's the kind of thing where you can't play it with other people around because they get angry and they're like, what the fuck are you listening to? It sounds like eight computers trying to fuck. And but I like that's me. Like, I but that's why I'm like, if you love the dead, you should. You've earned your love. I don't get to speak because I've seen a lot of progressive bands that I think I should be made fun of for liking.
Right.
Hey, do you guys, out of all the food you saw in this movie, what if you like, let's say, okay, someone gives you a gift certificate to Noma in 2015. You can go to Copenhagen for free. You can order one item that you saw in this movie. Obviously, you just get luck of the draw the day you get there. The menu changes every day. But what was there one thing that you actually was like, I'd like to check
absolutely.
That out.
There is. And it's not the ants, which still boggles my mind. For me,
what are they on? Ants on cream? I didn't even know what they were.
They were like on sour cream, and one of them was crawling off the fucking plate. It's no wonder you had health violations. You literally are serving the thing that the health people come in and look for. You know, what's next? Rat pizza? I haven't
seen my hornet's nest menu that I have.
I'll tell you exactly what I want to eat with my gift certificate to fucking Noma is that thing at the very beginning that was wrapped in aluminum that they were barbecuing, and then he rolled in like pomegranate seeds
and
eyes or whatever.
Yeah.
That thing looked awesome, and it looked
the Adventure Time ribs.
yeah. I don't even know what was on it or if it was even meat, but it looked fucking good, and it was weird. And I like sprinkles, and it seemed to have sprinkles on it.
So. I was trying to figure out what that was. It resembled a bone, and they wrapped it in tinfoil, which I thought, it must be a bone, so it didn't get burned, so it stayed its natural white color. And then some kind of marrow. I think what he did is he wrapped the bone in marrow and then barbecued the marrow into a caramel.
Yeah.
And then sprinkled stuff on top of that caramel, which is a bone marrow. I think that's where he was going with it. But that I would definitely try. Everything at Noma I would try. I mean, the ants are like, that's kind of a fuck you rich guy kind of thing. It seems like. Like, why don't you fucking eat ants? You know, and they're like, I love ants. They're the best ants I've ever had. Ooh.
Right.
This isn't my train on Snowpiercer. Why am I eating these? Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes, though, is when he brings that fucking smoked egg thingy, Mabob, to that table.
Oh, that smoker,
And he's like, "It's we smoked it with lemon snodgrass." And the guy's like, my last name is Snodgrass. And he's like, yes, we know. We did that for you on purpose. I'm like, this guy's lying out of his ass. You know, like, it's just like, yeah, sure. This ain't cost you $800, so yeah, we made it for you because your last name was the same as whatever ingredient we put in this thing. What about you, George? What would you eat?
I mean, when I was thinking about this, like the least appealing thing to me was like the rose with like the green liquid poured on it. I'm just like, whatever that is, I don't like what's happening here. It feels like a cake topping. And then the ribs, I kept thinking, when I think of this movie right now, I picture that rib. I think it's a rib with like the like sparkly, like Pendleton Ward, like, you know, cartoon like elements to it. Yeah. I'm not a big smoker guy. I don't really understand everything. I watched Final Table. Did you guys watch Final Table?
Yeah.
Yeah, Derek watched Final Table. Paco did not watch Final Table. That's a one-season Netflix show where it's very smart. Like, but everyone in that was doing shit with smokers. And I'm like, I don't really understand the smoker world for food. But I'm not a big fermenter guy. So I think the fermentation room was not like super appealing to me. But yeah, meats. I loved also that there was that one lady. He flipped out when one lady didn't finish her plate. Oh. Do you remember that scene?
Oh yeah.
I'm like, that's like, that is how we are when we see one person like,
oh my
laughing.
God, right. You're right. We all focus on the one person that's not enjoying our stand-up. Yep. Yeah. And he was like, well, take it back to her. Convince her. Like, what the fuck?
I'll do 15 more minutes just for you.
Yeah. The waiter was like, she doesn't want to eat it. It's like us shoving merchandise to the one guy that didn't like us. Like, take my CD for free. And he's like, I didn't enjoy your stand-up live for free. You know?
Like, you can have 100 people having the best time of their life. And I will go right for the one motherfucker with their arms crossed every time, and that'll ruin my night.
Time. And they're They're usually not. A lot of times, they're the first person that comes up to you and goes, "Man, that was awesome." And you're just like, "You look like you wanted to die. Are you like seriously? Like, I thought you hated me." Some people just have that face where they're just like, "I'm not enjoying this, and I won't ever."
We could have done, you know, the dishes with leeks from Belgium and potatoes from Holland and strawberries from France. But of course, the taste, as we all know, is related to the place. So the taste would have been, you know, 5 to 10% different, and maybe even 5 to 10% less good because of the qualities of this cold climate to things such as vegetables. The fact that we restricted ourselves to cooking with whatever we have here now made a very big difference.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Gotta cast this dog. Gotta cast this dog.
So, Derek, we do play a game called Cast This Doc, where we try to cast the people in the documentary if there was to be a biopic, which is now like the world was going crazy over Tiger King, about casting Tiger King. We've been playing this game for 5 years on this podcast. No, I'm not bitter. So you guys want to go? I have some ideas. I don't know. George, you have some ideas?
Yeah, I had a lot of trouble thinking about who I wanted to play Rene or Giuseppe because he has like sort of like a face of a lot of people I know, but not like any actors that I know, which is just sort of like he has sort of like soft, sad eyes. And he just, like I said, he looks to me like a jungle DJ. Like if you said he was on the cover of The Wire as like, oh, this is Aphex Twin's cousin, I would just believe that. he just looks built for an anorak. But I thought of an actor. I was just kind of brain flashing, and it took me a while to research this actor's name and figure out who is. French actor named Daniel Auteuil, A-U-T-E-I-L. He was like in Queen Margot, and he played the Marquis de Sade. So like the younger version of him, he's in like Manon of the Spring. He's like, you know, like him in the 80s. I think that he kind of has a similar like look to him. So that's a pretty obscure one. But if I send you a link, you guys will know what I'm talking about. And then there's one dude who like is an American who just talks to the camera a lot, just like, yeah, no one tries to get pickles as hard as us. And that guy just like Paul Scheer. He just ran with Paul Scheer.
He's
balding.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, that's good. Derek, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely the first thing I thought about with Rene would be Paul Rudd. Paul Rudd would make a great Rene Redzepi, and especially if it was not a biopic. But but I was like, I could see Paul Rudd doing it, and it would make me like the movie more. As far as like the people around him, like I saw, God damn it, who's the dude that plays Hagrid? For some reason, that is right in the
Robbie Coltrane.
Right. Robbie Coltrane. Robbie Coltrane is the guy who gets the sap out of the trees.
That's funny.
Like I saw a bunch of different people. I saw my friend Jake Silverman. I was like, that guy is the dude, the lanky white dude who works in the kitchen next to him, who just keeps getting yelled at, but is like, I'm your best fucking friend, man. There's Why are you so mad guys. At me? Yeah,
the guy with the kind of like surfer hair, or the guy with just the armband tattoos.
The guy with the surfer hair would be Silverman. Yeah.
And that's a classic. That's a classic comedy archetype. The two bumbling fools, you know, like it's so very comedy dell'arte. You know, it's like
it's like IT Crowd because there's also the woman. I didn't cast her. I didn't get her name, but I'm just like she kind of reminds me of like Fairuza Balk. So I just throw that in there.
Oh right, yeah, that's interesting. I cast for Renee Luke Wilson. I think Luke Wilson could probably. Or is that Owen? Wait, which one's the dark-haired one? That's Luke, right?
Luke, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Luke Wilson. And then for everyone else, Chris Hemsworth. He just plays everyone else.
How tall was everyone in this movie? I didn't realize. I just watched it again. I'm like, everyone's fucking tall in Denmark. Or he's probably 5'8" or something, but then there's all these giants next to him.
Everyone's so pretty in this documentary.
You've got all these Nordic giants, and then you've got this Macedonian who's easily just dwarfed by everybody, which of course I'm sure gives him an inferiority complex, which is why he yells at those guys. Your fucking perfect chins and your excellent necks. Go get me lemon thyme.
The lemon thyme.
Just you want to go out to party? I'm going to make sure you work till 2 a.m.
And also, what about the moment on the fucking ceiling when on the roof and he's like, imagine it. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine it? And I've been in that situation where I'm like, yeah, that's going to be great, boss. Like, get me the fuck out of here. Like, why am I on a roof with my boss pretending I see his vision, which I don't, to save my job, you know?
Also, have either of you had a boss that has a GoPro on with them at all times? Because that's a lot of this movie was like a GoPro on his shoulder. Like, I didn't realize it until I watched it again. When he's doing the uni thing, you can see the reflection of his face in the soup because he's got a GoPro over his shoulder.
Oh, man. It reminded me, that scene reminded me of a boss that I did have who spent a half hour trying to tell me how cool it's going to be that he invested in an LED light up sign that he can put any word he wants to into it, and it'll flash. And numbers, man. Now look, I know it cost me $1,000, but it's going to really raise our awareness. People are going to see us from the street. Right. I can advertise our specials on it. And I was like, I work in the kitchen, dude. I have to say this is a great idea, but...
You have to.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if we all had aprons? That would be nice.
Wouldn't it be neat if we got paid more than once a month?
Yeah.
That'd be kind of fun. I used to have a boss that would have us come into his office when he made any money, and he did what he called the money dance on his desk and made us watch him when he made money, and we were still getting paid like $9 an hour. Yeah, exactly. The collective.
That needs a where are they now, too. That guy is probably like, is something ironic has happened. Like, he doesn't have shoes anymore. He had to sell his shoes. Yeah, do the money dance. I live on broken glass now.
What a dick that guy was. So I really enjoyed this documentary too. I thought this was great. Thank you, Derek, for bringing this to our attention. I had never heard of it either, and I thought it was awesome. I liked it. It was kind of a fun ride because and it's beautifully shot. Like they did a really
so nice. Yeah.
I've never heard of documentary films before.
The director is Pierre Deschamps, and like he's done a lot of other documentary stuff. I looked it up a little bit. Yeah, documentary. It's a fun name. Oh, my cat just got in the way. Oh, a little bit.
Ah, what a cutie. Big orange fluff ball. Speaking of Nordics, the orange cats are that's a Viking cat, you know. That's what they raised those and brought them to made them a real thing. Orange cats, orange cats are directly related to Nordic heritage. They liked the Vikings, loved them, so they brought them everywhere.
Oh, weird. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
The Vikings are pretty cool.
They were all right. They were kind of, you know, I mean, I'm sure some of them were cool. You know, some of them were probably not cool.
I like Nordic mythology. I like Norse mythology and all that stuff. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Let's see. Should we do a pitch a doc real fast or no?
I don't really have one, but okay. You do. So if you want to pitch it, baby. Pitch it away.
Well, I wanted to, Derek, so we do pitch a doc just like if you have an idea of something you'd like to see made into a documentary, like something you're interested in that hasn't been made into a documentary yet, as far as you know. If you, it's your chance to tell all of our listeners who are all documentary filmmakers, and then you can get co-producer credit.
Yay! Me? Can I do it? Are you guys ready for my pitch?
Yeah.
One of my biggest stand-up heroes, he's not really a stand-up, but it's the person who influenced me the most, was Brother Theodore. Theodore was his family was he survived Auschwitz. Some of his family did. When he got out of Auschwitz, he moved back to Austria and started doing theater. And decided to use his pain and the horror of concentration camps to sort of as a means to sort of talk about these things that he could find humor in the darkest, most possible places. So his whole life was basically spent turning over these rocks and, you know, taking people to these really uncomfortable places. But he had an incredibly colorful life. I mean, he was not only a character actor, but, you know, he had a long run in New York of one-man shows that were they were amazing. They were dark. They were loud. He just had this persona that was it was all his. He had what my friend Trey Gunn calls an original voice. It was his own thing. And no one really did. No one's done anything about Brother Theodore, but he was incredibly influential, especially in, you know, the bohemian crowds in New York at the time, influenced, I think, Lord Byron and some of these other guys who were like hipster poets, but also had a very dark, sad life and found ways to make it funny, but not funny in the ways that normal people would be like, this is, you know, I'm getting dark, the kind of shit that I think, right. I mean, I gravitate towards that anyways, and I think that's why, but just his Letterman appearances alone.
Exactly.
Thank holy you. Shit, you know, I mean, I want to see a documentary.
On Letterman.
Letterman loved him.
On Letterman. Yeah.
Letterman loved
so
him.
Weird. He was so dark and weird, and you never knew what he was going to say. And I had no idea who the fuck he was when I was a kid, other than I loved when he was on Letterman. It was kind of like Larry Bud Melman. It's like, who are these people? I didn't even, until you just said that, had no idea that he was a theater actor. Like,
And if I had to pitch the biopic, I would pitch Patton Oswalt to play him.
Fuck.
I've mentioned that on more than one occasion. In Patton's presence, I was like, just chase that tail. Will you please just make that happen? So he'd be perfect.
Let me ask you a question, Derek. Would you set it in when he was, what, probably in the 70s or 80s when he was on Letterman? Would you set it in, like, when he was in his 40s or 30s? What time period would you put that biopic in?
I would sort of do, like, a 15 to 20-minute chunk of each period of his life because they were successive but all very unique. You know, from the 40s, the 30s and 40s, growing up in Austria and then spending time in a concentration camp, then being reintegrated and then becoming an entertainer in his late teens, early 20s, and then moving to the States and then New York and being the toast of the town. And then, you know, having the 70s and 80s, you know, which was a weird time for everybody, and Letterman and, you know, in the Burbs and becoming kind of a Hollywood, you know, go to for weirdo B actors, you know, character actors.
That's awesome. I completely forgot about him, and I'm so glad you brought him up because I was a Letterman fanatic as a kid, and I loved
me too.
Letterman. Yeah,
me too. That's where I found him. That's where I discovered him when I was a kid, and I went, everything about this guy. I need to know everything, every like book, Elliott. Every record.
Yeah,
God.
Like watching Chris Elliott on Letterman, I was like, what is happening, and how much do I love this band with all my heart? Always love Chris Elliott. That's awesome. That's maybe one of the best pitch of docs we've had. I mean, that's an awesome tale.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, that could totally be made into something. Okay, I wanted to just talk about this guy who derailed a train to draw attention to the fact that he thought what was going on this ship that was supposed to be like a spillover of hospital beds, I think in Long Beach or something, was... a secret government cover-up, and like that wasn't even going to be a ship for coronavirus patients. It's for people that were spillovers because there were too many coronavirus beds being taken up. And I love weirdos when no one actually gets killed, like just conspiracy nuts where it's there's no body count, but derailing a train's fucking like what. Paco, you've been watching these like people taking weird vehicles and destroying parts of towns.
I love them.
Kick.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Tread is a great one. Not quite. I mean, was he the conductor? Did he take it over?
I think he was a conductor, and I think he like posted something to like social media about why he was doing it, and then they just dragged him off, being like, "Yeah, you just derailed a train. That is the opposite of your job." That is not what your job is.
And it was nowhere near that boat. Like, there's no way he would have hit that boat.
I don't think he quite understood the physics behind trains, tracks, and distance.
Yeah.
No.
It's like hijacking a train.
It's like hijacking a roller coaster.
Right. Yeah.
Where are you going to go? you know?
Nowhere but fast. That's pretty much, you're going to go but you're going
to
get
there
fast.
You can keep yelling at us and waving that gun, but we're not going to fucking Florida. It's not going to happen.
Right. That's hilarious. Okay, so thank you, Derek. I want to talk about your album because your comedy album's coming out. But first, tell people where they can find you online. That kind of stuff.
You can find me. My website is DerekSheenRules, RULZ.com. You can find me at Derek Sheen on Twitter and Derek Sheen 666 at Instagram. Instagram at Derek Sheen 666. Not because there was a Derek Sheen 665 was taken, just because I thought it'd be fun to do that. And all my other stuff's on my website and Spotify. My Spotify channel has all my albums on it now, all four of them, four albums of which no one ever asked for. I just consistently disappoint people by continuing to make an album when everyone's like, oh, we didn't even hear the other three. And I'm like, how about another one?
The guy who runs Stand Up Records must have asked you for it.
Dan asked me for it. Dan wanted me to do it. If I make one person happy, that's a terrible
and it's called
ratio.
Macho Caballero, and it just came out. And so you can find that on all streaming services. And thank you for sharing your love of Danish cuisine with us, Derek.
Thank you for letting me. I'm glad I got to share this doc with everybody. So I'm glad. And what a fun talk with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com.
We've been recapping reality since 2015.
Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scovel.
For as little as $1 a month, you can donate to this show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
If you want to help us out in other ways, please share the show with friends. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
Find out more about Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on our website.
SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans. So if you want to advertise with SupDoc, got a film you want to recommend, or any opinions, please hit us up.
Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.